I'm becoming an alcoholic.
How about you?
They just asked me to do this a few minutes ago, so I was trying to figure out all the things that I could say about Alan. I don't want to stand up here too long. So I met Alan about 11 years ago. I was at an AA meeting, and I was trying to make sure I wasn't 13th stepping when he asked me to go have lunch. And I asked him how long he'd been sober, and he said 29 years. And he kind of floated into the room and out of the room. Yeah, I'm going to go out to dinner with you. And he had, like, all the best speaker tapes in his car. And that was probably the moment I fell in love. So I start dating this tall, skinny redneck from Alabama. And he turns out to be the most precious human being. He's always the same person. And I think that, I mean, it's obvious because that has to do with Alcoholics Anonymous. That's the thing that's number one to him. And it is awesome to have family in AA. We have a daughter in AA too. And I want to say happy birthday to all the celebrants. I think birthdays are the best. And I love to watch other people pick up chips. Even if it's like three in a row, I think it's awesome. anyway, here I give you Alan.
Hi, everybody. I'm Alan. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey.
Y'all hear me in the back? All right. I didn't think that'd be a problem. It's always an honor to be asked to speak anywhere. And I'm grateful for that. Thank you, Michael. I was speaking over in Cumming at the beginning of this meeting, and he happened to be there and asked me to come over here tonight. And I'm really grateful that I'm asked to do anything nowadays, as you'll find out from in just a few minutes. I'll just jump in here. I was born way back in 1961. In a little town in North Alabama called Hartsville, Alabama. They took me to the town next to it, which was just barely a little bit bigger, and that's where I grew up on the Tennessee River in Decatur, Alabama. And, you know, we went, the family, was all about the Southern Baptist Church and school. Hank keeps cutting that cake, man. I get distracted. Y'all forgive me. No, it's not you. It's the smell. I like cake. You might not can tell it by looking at me. I like cake. It was church and school. And that was pretty much it for me. And when I got on up in high school, I was on the track team and the guys, we were headed to some track meet, that was out of the city and, ended up riding with some seniors. And I was a freshman in high school. I was like 15 or 16. And on the way back from the track meet, they stopped and, they had already iced down some beer, and they popped the trunk, and they handed everybody a beer, and they're like, "Alan, you want a beer?" And in the Baptist church that I went to, if you drank, you were going to hell. this is the way I'd been raised. My parents were teetotalers. There wasn't any drinking around. The only drinking I saw was what was on TV. And, that's all a lie. So, so I said yes. And I drank that beer, got home, went to bed, got up the next morning, and I hadn't gone to hell. You know? And I was like, they're lying to me. You know? So I was wondering, I started thinking right then, what else are they lying about? You know? And so I just started heading that way, went to, the next time I drank was at a high school football game and dance, in between the football game and the dance. I drank. Don't remember too much about that night. And I don't know if that's because I blacked out that night or I just drank so much since then that I don't remember. And then I started running with some guys. One of my friends from church introduced me to some guys who had a trailer that was outside in the county, way out in the middle of nowhere. And I went there and walked in, and there was a table like these tables. And it was full of guns and drugs, and alcohol was everywhere. And, you know, I'm an alcoholic, and I believe in the singleness of purpose, but to stand up here and tell you there weren't drugs flying everywhere when I'm out there running, I was just washing them all down with alcohol. There was always alcohol on the table, you know. I could get that. You know, when I was 16 years old, I lived in a dry county, but I found out where all the bootleggers were, and I'd just drive over to the next county, and there was a state store, and I'd buy my Jack Daniels whiskey and whatever else I wanted. And, you know, as long as I had the money, there wasn't any ID, there wasn't anything like that. You know, this was like in the late 70s over there. And so I was drinking and driving and buying it and everything and whatever. Nobody thought anything about it. But when I went in that trailer, I started going back to that trailer over and over again. And, you know, these guys were like mid-20s. I'm a kid in there. But I think I've got the world by the tail, you know, because of the effect that alcohol's having on me. You know, I can stand up straighter. I can talk to the girls. I can, you know, whatever. I liked it. And so I start going back out there, and you have to stop. They didn't have cell phones. You have to stop at a pay phone, drop a dime in. That's how old I am. Drop a dime in and call out there to get the right knock when you knock on the trailer door. Because like I said, there's guns on the table too, and they're selling everything. And you know, I'm out there a little while, and I'm sitting there one night. Of course, anytime I'm out there, and anytime I'm talking about this, I've got about three different substances in me, and I'm drinking too, you know. And I don't know if I'm going up or down or sideways or whatever. That's just how I ran. And you know, more was better. And you know, I'd been around guns my whole life, and I picked up that revolver that was on the table, and I just opened it, spun it, saw that it was loaded, clicked it back in place, and set it back down on the table. And about, seemed like just a few seconds later, and you gotta remember how just stoned out of my mind I am, so it could have been minutes later, but Terry, the guy who owned the trailer, was behind me, and he said, "Alan," and I turned around, and he had that same gun pointed right at my face, and he pulled the trigger, and it went click, and everybody in the room laughed, you know, and I tried to bring up a very nervous laugh, you know, but, you know, basically what he was telling me, if you roll on us, we'll just shoot you. Nobody's going to hear the gunshot. We're out here in the middle of nowhere, and we'll drop you in one of those caves out there, and nobody will ever find you. And, you know, the insanity of that is I continued to go back out to that trailer. You know, that was my supply. I mean, I'm like 16 years old, and these are the people I know, and I'm going to high school and doing all that. Well, anyway, after about a year and a half of that, I'm just bouncing off the freaking walls, you know, because I'm doing just everything as much as I can do and hiding it from my parents, and they're dragging me to church on Sundays. But at that point, they put me in a treatment center. My parents do. They had me talk to this psychiatrist, and he locks me up in this treatment center. And he says, I have some problems with my thoughts. Imagine that. And he puts me on Thorazine. I don't know if y'all know much about that. But if you're on Thorazine, it's like old school TV, you know, that had the snow in between the channels. Okay. Well, it's like my brain's on one of the snow channels. Okay. The TV's on, but nothing's playing. Okay. And that's how that did me. And, you know, the first thing on there is the label that says, don't drink with this. Well, as soon as I got out of there, I was, you know, drinking and doing all the other stuff I did. With it. While I was in there, I was in there for like 5 months. My dad had really good insurance. And I wasn't an alcoholic. I was too young to be an alcoholic. See, I was like 17 years old. And back then, in North Alabama at least, they just didn't view me that way. And one of the reasons was, is I was lying about everything. You know, I wasn't going to tell them the truth, what I was doing and how much I was drinking and everything else. So I lied about everything, said I had a couple of drinks every now and then on the weekend or whatever. You know, so they had no choice but to think I had some kind of mental issue, which I guess step two tells me I do anyway. But perception thing anyway. So they put me in there, and they put me on the adolescent unit, which is not an alcohol and drug unit. You know, it's just the all of the crazy folks I'm there with. And it's a good thing. See, there's so many God things in this story, because we'd be standing there at the end of the hall, and we all had to go eat together, all that other stuff, and we'd be standing there waiting. And the people on the adult unit, every now and then, one of them would come out of this door behind the nurse's station, and they'd look like they'd had their finger stuck in a light socket. Well, what they were doing to those people was called shock treatments. And they were frying their brain in a whole different way. And anyway, so if they had put me on that unit, they'd have probably shocked my brain too. I have no idea. But see, to me, that's a God thing. He's like, we'll put you over here. And see, I wasn't doing anything to deserve any of that kind of grace at all. Anyway, another story in there is, you know, after about 5 months, we're sitting in one of those little therapy sessions, and one of the counselors, she was like 22 or something, I don't know, and I was 17, and you know how 17-year-olds are, and we're supposed to write a song down and give the song to one of the other people and tell them why we gave them that song. Well, everybody was handing all the other patients their song, and it got my turn, and I handed her, the counselor, my song. And it was Eddie Money's Two Tickets to Paradise. And she sat there and thought about it. And then, after she thought about it, she got embarrassed. And I don't know how long later it was, but in there, you know, you had two people to the room, and the guy, Byron, that was in the room with me, there were two female counselors. And after hours, lights were out, we were already in bed, you know, supposed to be going to sleep, and the door busts open, and the girl I gave the two tickets to paradise, she comes and jumps in bed with me, and the other one goes and jumps in bed with him, you know. And a little while later, we were both discharged from the facility. I don't know if anybody ever found that out, but I guess they got to thinking about it and thought they should get us out of there pretty quick before they lost their job or something worse happened. But anyway, so I get out of there and I go right back to it just as hard as ever. And I got a hold of some stuff called PCP, which is horse tranquilizer. You know, and I'm drinking on that. And every time I drink, every time I smoke pot, every time I do anything at all, I am going into hallucinations. I don't even have to do PCP anymore. You know, after I did a run on that. And I'm hallucinating, and I can't not drink or not do that stuff because I'm trying to catch that just right spot, that buzz where I'm okay, you know. In any other time, I'm not okay. My head's just rolling, and that juggernaut, as they call it in the book, is just rolling down on me, you know. And so I have to drink just to function at all. And I'm doing crazy things like, after a while of that, you can't tell the truth from the false. I mean, that's a very true statement in the doctor's opinion. You know, because I can't remember what I hallucinated and what really happened. You know, and it becomes very confusing. And I'm angry and everything else, you know, at my situation because people just won't treat me right. I'm doing stuff like, now, my parents always provided well for me, you know. I had clothes, shoes, food, roof over my head, and some things that a lot of people didn't have. I'm stealing money out of my dad's wallet, okay? And I'm going to the store to get a pack of cigarettes, okay? And I'm out of cigarettes, I go steal the money, and I go to the store, and I walk in the store, and the clerk behind the counter is eyeballing me, you know. And I don't like you to eyeball me, you know, and look me up and down and act like there's a problem. And so I'm eyeballing him back and just, you know, I get my cigarettes and I'm standing in the store. And the reason I'm standing in the store is I'm trying to get warm because I went to the store in a pair of blue jeans. No shoes, no socks, no shirt. It's winter. It's like 20 degrees outside, okay? And I walked a mile and a half to do that because that's what I wanted to do, and that's the way I was. You know, and he had every right to eyeball me. But I'm like, what are you eyeballing me for? I'd eyeball me. I'd probably call the law if somebody walked in my store like that. But I'm doing crazy things like that. And one night, my dad is going to have a family discussion with me. Subject is me. You know, I don't know if y'all have experienced those, but I don't like those. I just come in, I don't know, it's like real late at night, and he was sitting in the chair, and he asked me to sit down so he could talk to me. And then he got up out of his chair. Well, I was so paranoid that I thought he was coming after me, and I pushed him up against the wall of his own house, and I told him, don't you ever come after me, I'll kill you. Well, that's all he needed, you know. He could have mopped the floor with me. I was probably 100 pounds, you know, 6'1", 100 pounds. You think I'm thin now? Not too long later, the sheriff's car pulled up in the driveway, and they came in the house, and they cuffed me and put me in the back of the car. And he had gone to the probate judge, and he wasn't going to file charges if they threw me in jail. He wanted me to go somewhere where I could get some help. And so we had a court hearing. And I'm sitting on one side, and they're sitting on the other side. They threw me in some rubber room at the hospital, waiting on the court thing, and like 13 orderlies came in there, big guys, to get my shoes and belt. I weighed like 100 pounds, maybe, you know. And but I'm unpredictable. I'm not tough. I'm not mean, but I'm like, you don't know what I'm going to do next kind of person, you know. And people just steer clear of those kind of people. They don't want anything to do with them because they're, you know, they see them go crazy every now and then, and they're like, just stay away from them and leave them alone. Anyway, go to court, parents sitting on the other side. This guy walks in that I'd never met before, and he's my court-appointed attorney. They give their side of the story, all lies. No. But that's what I think, you know. And so I'm talking to my attorney, and they're, you know, we're getting loud after they finish their side of the story. And the judge goes, what is going on over there? And my court-appointed attorney stood up and said, I don't want to represent him. And the judge says, you have to. And they went back and forth a little while. And the judge goes, why do you not want to represent him? And he goes, he wants to get up there and testify, and I'm advising him against it. And the judge says, bring him on up here. And so I went up there, and I told them how they were liars, and they didn't, you know, I straightened them out. And told them the truth as I saw it. And as soon as I got done straightening them out, the judge dropped the gavel and said, take him away. Now, I don't know if y'all have ever heard of it. 1013, that's where they throw you in a place and evaluate, throw you in a nut hut or whatever and evaluate you and all that kind of thing. Well, this wasn't a 1013. This was a court order that you're locked away for life in an insane asylum. Okay? Because in the psychiatrist that was over the program that I saw when I was 17 testified there that I would never walk around out here without being on medication, that I would always have to have some sort of supervision, that I would never hold a job, so forth and so on, that I was just gone. I was out of society. You know, and that's what they did. They locked me out of society. And threw me in the back of a sheriff's car, and up we went to the insane asylum. I got to get sober. You know, I walk in there, and we're going to, all the people are going to dinner or whatever, and so I go down to dinner and I'm trying to choke down some cornbread or something, and that's the last thing I remember. The next thing I remember, I wake up. Well, I had flashes of coming in and out. You know, they had floors like this with little specks on them, you know, and the little specks were turning into bugs and they were just crawling in massive numbers over the top of me. And I know today that I was going through DTs and withdrawals. I'm 19 years old, okay? When I come to, I tried to move and I couldn't because they had me four-point restraint to the bed. They had my legs and my arms tied down and had a strap across my chest. And, you know, I'm scared to death. I'm already scared because I don't really know where I am. I know I'm in a place where there's a bunch of crazy folks, and now I'm strapped down to a bed. It's a pretty helpless feeling. You know, it's kind of like your life being unmanageable or you're powerless. And anyway, after talking to them for a while, they told me if I was going to be good that they'd untie me, and they did. And after talking with them a little while more, I found out I tried to fight three people all the way back up to the room, and they had to have two or three or four orderlies take me down and hit me with a shot before they'd get me back up there and tie me down. They weighed everybody in there every week. You know, you line up in a little line behind all the other crazy people and you get on the scale. They wouldn't weigh me for 2 weeks. When they did weigh me, I weighed 115 pounds. So, and they were cramming food in me like you wouldn't believe, you know, for 2 weeks before they'd even weigh me at 115 pounds. So I figure I was down to 100 or maybe less. I don't know. Anyway, whatever. I got to my room one night and I realized the hopelessness of my situation. I'm locked up for life in an insane asylum. I'm still a teenager. And I got down on my knees and I just said, I don't know what you are. I don't know what you want from me. You can do whatever you want with me. Just help me. You know, because I realized the nature of my situation. I had a couple of brain cells left, you know. And I got up and I didn't think anything else about it. Next day. And I'm standing at the nurse's station trying to get a cigarette. And another nurse walks up right before I got there. And they were like right in front of me. And she shows her a sheet of paper and says, are these the people that are going to the AA meeting tonight? Something clicked in my brain. Because the girl, the two tickets to Paradise girl, I tried to look her up after I got out of there. She introduced me to her dad. And I talked to Bill for a while. And he was in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. So when she said AA, when that nurse said AA, something clicked in my brain and goes, oh, AA. And so I let them finish talking, being the southern gentleman I was. I didn't interrupt them. And whatever. And I leaned around there and asked for a cigarette. And then I asked, can I go to that AA meeting? That nurse pulls that chart and she starts looking through the chart and she says, it doesn't say anything in here. You know, they had every diagnosis in the world for me. Except that. And I was probably acting that way. You know? That Jekyll and Hyde kind of thing. And she said, now normally we'd have to go bring this into a staff meeting, have it approved, whatever. She said, but if you won't pitch a fit, if they don't approve it tomorrow, I'll let you go tonight. And then if they approve it, you can continue to go. And I said, fine. Or something like that. And I went to that meeting that night. And this 6'4" bald-headed Marine with Clark Kent glasses walks in, and he's in his uniform, career gunny sergeant. Okay. And as you probably already figured out, the reason I already know that I know all this, and Ken's telling his story to all of the crazy folks, you know. And he tells his story and he says, if anybody needs a sponsor after he gets done, that was his mistake. And I went to him after he was done, you know, and I said, will you sponsor me? And I had no idea what I was asking for. Okay. I had no clue at the time the series of events that God brought together to put Ken in that place and put me in that place at the same time. And all the people at the Hartzell group, which is where I got sober, were telling Ken, why are you going up there? Why are you carrying a meeting up there? Nobody's ever come out of there. Nobody's going to come out of there. But God had put it on him to go up there and hold the meeting. You know, was that for me? You're darn right it was. It may have been for some other reasons too, but I know it was for me. Because I found that God works that way. You know, He doesn't just do something and it affects one person most of the time. Normally it affects a whole string of people. You know. Anyway, Ken started taking me to meetings, signing me out, which is unheard of. I start reading the book. I start doing the assignments that Ken gives me. I start lining up behind the crazy people at the payphone in the institution. Think One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. Okay, this is where I'm at. Okay, and I drop the dime in and I call Ken and I don't even know what to say. You know, but I'm just doing what he told me to do. And I asked them to take me off of all medication. That doesn't happen in these places. but they approved that for me. Okay. And that was February 15, 1981. Since that time, I hadn't had any psychiatric drugs. I hadn't had any street drugs. I hadn't had a drink of alcohol. I hadn't had anything. And I'm very grateful for every single second, minute, hour, day of that. Of course, Ken starts taking me through the steps. I get out of this place, and my, you know, everybody that gets out of there, they got like a 6-month hold on you where they can just jerk you right back in. You don't have to go back in front of the judge. You know, you have to follow up with mental health and see psychiatrists and all. None of that was on my thing. There was only one thing on my follow-up that I had to do, and that was go to 3 meetings, Alcoholics Anonymous meetings every week. And I went to a meeting every night for the first 2 years and needed every darn one of them. You know, people were scared to sit with me, by me. Yeah, I still look wild as you can imagine. And they wouldn't sit by me in the meeting. And Ken would sit on one side of me, and his sponsor, Tommy, which became my sponsor too, they kind of co-sponsored me because I needed more than one. I was a handful. And he'd sit on the other side of me, and his wife, Ann, would sit on the other side of Tommy. And Ken took me through the steps. I had no problem at all. Am I powerless? You're darn right I am. I'd already found that out. Is my life unmanageable? Didn't look like I had much to manage. You couldn't look anywhere in my life and see anything good going on, you know. And even, I'd burned it all down. My parents let me back in their house, you know. And step two, I had papers that said I was insane and needed to be restored to sanity, you know. I mean, but what that really was about was, you know, I could all, and still today, I can look at the outside circumstances, but it's what's in here. See, I had to get step one in here. I had to surrender in here. And I had to admit that I was insane and needed to be restored to sanity on the inside. You know? And I turned my will and my life over to God after having a very long talk with my sponsor about, you know, because I'd been told who God was the whole time I was growing up. And I just couldn't swallow that big, it was just too much for me to swallow. And he goes, well, nobody can tell you who God is. And you can just use the group conscious as a whole, not just one person, just the group conscious as a whole. And I was like, okay. He goes, somebody says something over here and you like that, and somebody says something over here and you don't have to take that. And you just put all that stuff you like together. And I'm like, okay. And he says, and talk to me about it. You know, cause he was, you know, and after about 3 years, the man I pushed up against the wall of his own house came to me. Sorry, I'm getting emotional. And told me that he thought what I was doing was a good thing. See, it took 3 years for him to think maybe the other shoe wasn't going to drop this time. You know. And him and I had a, like, true father-son relationship after that. Until he passed away in 97 from pancreas cancer. And that's why I get emotional talking about him, you know, because this is a relationship I wouldn't have if it wasn't for Alcoholics Anonymous. Any of my relationships are relationships my beautiful wife, I wouldn't have a relationship with her if it wasn't for Alcoholics Anonymous and our 2 daughters and our 4 grand. I had to stop for a minute because we just had the youngest one 6 months old now. from 13 to 6 months old, four grandchildren, you know. And, you know, that's my life now. I was telling you my life before. My life now is Alcoholics Anonymous and my family. And we occasionally go to church, believe it or not. And but I had to work through a lot of resentment and a lot of things. And I had to redefine when they said something. I had to go, okay, what does that mean to me now? You know, so I could get to the message. But, you know, did step four and five, and I'm at about a year mark. You know, they slowed me way down. They put like big anchors on me and slowed me way down. I'm at about a year mark, and I walk in the group cleanup, and Tommy, my sponsor's there, and Ken had, you know, he's career Marine, and he had to go where they told him, and he had already gone to California, so I'm working with Tommy. And Tommy, and my ego's out to here. I can barely fit my head through the door, you know, because I'm 19 years old. Well, I guess 20 at that point. I'm 20 years old, and I've already got a year, and all of y'all are old, you know, and I'm thinking I'm going to get a bunch, you know, and it, you know, it's like Tommy always told me, he goes, you may not get a bunch, you don't know, you know, you have to do the deal every day. I don't get to skip days, you know, because the greater aspect of my disease of alcoholism is still with me, because my mind is still with me, and that's where the greater aspect is. It's my perception, it's my thinking, it's my the way I look at life, and whether I think it's fair, or whether I think it's going the right way, or all of these things that want to trip me up and interrupt my conscious contact with God. But anyway, I walk in this group, clean up, and Tommy walks up to me, and he could see the ego. And he walks up to me, and he goes, Alan, you know I love you. Now, he had never said it quite that way to me before, and I go, yeah, it kind of took me back a little bit. And he goes, but I'm just now barely stand to be around you. And he turned around and went back over and started sweeping the floor. And, of course, my jaw hits the floor, you know. And he just chopped my legs right out from under me, you know. And I'm like, why can you barely stand? And what he was telling me is, yeah, you're not drinking and you're not doing any of that other stuff, but your behavior is off the chart still, you know, and your ego's way too big. And he knew when to chop me down, and he knew when to love me into the room. And, you know, of course, I went on and did the rest of the steps, and most of the people I went and made amends to just told me, said, you're doing great. Just whatever you're doing, you just keep doing that. They didn't understand, you know. But they could, and the reason they put it at nine, they don't let you out of the house till you get to step nine, you know, because you can do the rest of those at home on the couch with your sponsor, you know. And they let you out of the house to go talk to other people at step nine. Because they can see a change in you by the time you get there if you've really done this thing. See, this never fails. You know, if you're new and you just got here, came out of blackout, you're in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, it's a speaker's meeting. But, it never fails. This thing works every single time. It depends on my willingness and my honesty, and am I going to do it, you know? And it doesn't just work on alcohol. It works on all kinds of things, you know? And it's about me getting out of the way. It's about me being a maximum service to God and others. And it's about me getting those sponsees to come to my house on Tuesday night. And Becca gets her sponsees to come. At one time we had too many sponsees. You know, we have a full life and because of Alcoholics Anonymous, and we didn't have time to go through the book with five people, you know, and they're all new. So we go, everybody come to the house, you know, and on Tuesday night at 7 o'clock, we go through the big book. or we go through the 12 and 12, and then we go through the big book, and we go through, and we just, we've been doing that, what, 8 years, something like that? Something like that. And they all come to the house, and you know, to work with these new guys, and to watch the light come on, and to watch their life change, you know, and to watch their family be restored, is just more than I could ever ask for to be able to give back to them. Because I'm not supposed to be standing here, you know. I'm supposed to be running around in a nut ward drooling on myself, I guess. You know, the thing that they didn't, the thing that they didn't count on in this rescue story was God. And, you know, He reached in there and pulled me out when I was way gone. And I know you guys understand that. Thank you for letting me share. And I love you guys. Thank you.